The San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, October 15th of 1992 has an article by John Aloysius Farrell of the Boston Globe, Dateline Atlanta, headlined Scandal Dogs Bush Administration, subheaded Iran-Contra and Iraqgate, head list of concerns that haunt GOP campaign and its trust issue. Now again, I've gone into these scandals in the past in considerable detail and will be doing so in the future. It is not my purpose to do that in this broadcast, but simply in this massive archive series, but simply by way of taking a look at the effects of the Cold War, of having lost the Second World War on American democracy. We're just going to run through a number of these headlines very briefly and read short sections of some of these articles of the Bush administration. Recall that Iraqgate, the Iran-Contra scandal, and the October surprise in Slaw all have degrees of overlap, areas of overlap between them. Skipping down in this article, a senior administration official said Wednesday that the whole flap stemmed from a filing error. If there really had been a cover-up, the administration official said, the CIA would never have let Gonzalez see its classified evidence. Shoub reached a different conclusion. That's a judge looking into the BNL scandal. Quote, classified reports from the CIA conclude in part that a number of high-level BNL Rome officials supported Mr. Dragool's activities, unquote, Shoub wrote in an October 5th order. Quote, the CIA continues to be uncooperative in attempts to discover information about its knowledge of or involvement in the funding of Iraq by BNL Atlanta. Shoub then withdrew from the case. Let's take a look now, just as in the radio play High Command, the German character played by Paul Lucas referred to the naive American Dummkopfs, as he referred to them, to just begin reading their daily papers for confirmation of what he was talking about. So let's begin taking a look at the headlines in our papers here in 1992, because they reveal the effects of the success of the program being devised by fascists on both sides of the Atlantic in 1944, American-based fascists and the German fascists underlying the Third Reich. The San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, October 15th of 1992. This is an article dateline Washington by Faith Keenan and Seth Rosenfeld of the Examiner. It's headlined, Demos Probe Snooping on Clinton. This concerns the abuse of the State Department in attempting to link Bill Clinton with the KGB. Again, this is October 18th, 1992, for the benefit of those who eventually hear this program on tape. One of the major features of George Bush's campaign attacks on Bill Clinton has been, actually not Bush, proper, but Congressman Dornan from California has attempted to impugn Bill Clinton's patriotism by indicating that he may have had contacts with the KGB, kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald is supposed to have had. Moving on to the New York Times of Saturday, October 10th of 1992, article by David Johnston, Dateline Washington, October 9th, headline, Federal Agents Investigating Loss of Iran-Contra Papers. First paragraph reads, Federal agents are investigating a missing suitcase of classified documents that Lawrence E. Walsh, the Iran-Contra prosecutor, lost after he met secretly last summer with President Ronald Reagan in Los Angeles, an administration official said today. So the suitcase full of documents that Walsh took to interview Ronald Reagan with has mysteriously disappeared. That's a pattern we have viewed all too often in the past. Again, I'm going to be going into many of these articles at much greater length in weeks to come as we begin detailed analysis. This by way of merely cataloging, touching briefly on the symptoms of the disease that I've been discussing in Radio Free America 37. The San Francisco Examiner of Wednesday, September 30th of 1992. Story by Larry Margasack of the Associated Press, M-A-R-G-A-S-A-K, Dateline Washington, headlined, Republicans Kill Watergate Law, subheaded, Filibuster Threat Stops Bill to Ensure Inquiry of Misdeeds by U.S. Officials. First few paragraphs read, Senate Republicans have killed legislation to renew a post-Watergate law that assures independent investigations of wrongdoing by top government officials. The legislation died Tuesday when 28 Senate Republicans threatened to filibuster the measure, making it impossible to pass the bill in time for the Senate to adjourn early next week. The Republicans announced their intentions in a letter in which they protested, quote, the disgraceful indictment, unquote, of former Reagan administration Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger in the Iran-Contra investigation. And again, it would appear that the massive abuses of the national security state, which have corrupted our courts, they've corrupted our political process and our journalistic community. At this point, it is apparently the Republicans believe it is vital to continue to cover those up. Perhaps there is more than we have been led to suspect behind some of these things, but in any event, it is disturbing to note that the law passed as a result of the Watergate abuses has now been killed, and the compromised investigations of some of these national security scandals that we've seen in the past are, well, it's unlikely that future investigations will even achieve the degree of success they have, and those investigations have not been very successful. The New York Times of Monday, October 12th of 1992, a story by Elaine Shalino, Washington, October 11th. Headline, Justice Department now clashes with FBI over inquiry into bank loans to Iraq. It reads in part, even as Justice Department officials leveled new accusations at the Central Intelligence Agency, they found themselves in a dispute today with the FBI over how the department should investigate whether evidence was concealed in a politically sensitive case involving Iraq. At issue is whether the CIA or the Justice Department is to blame for providing incomplete and therefore misleading information to prosecutors and a federal judge in Atlanta about one of the largest bank frauds in history. The CIA says the Justice Department is to blame, and justice officials deny that. They also want to know why the CIA gave Congress classified information that could have been helpful in the case, but did not turn it over to them. Continuing. William S. Sessions, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has said he has opened an internal investigation of the problem that will be independent of his superiors at the Justice Department, according to Senator David L. Boren. Mr. Boren, B-O-R-E-N, an Oklahoma Democrat who was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said in an interview that Mr. Sessions had called him with assurances that, quote, justice will not participate in the inquiry and the FBI will not share information, unquote, until it is completed. That is so because Justice Department officials might be targets of the investigation. But at the Justice Department today, a spokesman disputed that, saying that the Justice Department is in charge of the internal investigation and that the FBI will be merely a participant. Quote, the department got the FBI into the investigation to assist us, unquote, said Paul McNulty, M-C-N-U-L-T-Y, a Justice Department spokesman. Quote, the public integrity section of the Justice Department is in charge, working with the FBI. Unquote. So the FBI and the Justice Department are now clashing concerning the call by the JD to begin investigating the CIA, and that clash is now apparently becoming more dramatic. Moving ahead to the New York Times of Wednesday, October 14th of 1992, Justice Department criminal unit is investigating the FBI chief, or investigating FBI chief, excuse me. Subheaded, ethics review comes as Bureau's help is asked in Iraq loan inquiry. That's by David Johnston of the New York Times, Dateline Washington, October 13th. So the clash between the Justice Department and the FBI concerning the proposal to, by J.D. for the FBI to help them investigate the CIA is now deepening, and an ethics investigation into William S. Sessions is underway. This figures to muddy the waters still further. Those waters will never spill through the Watergate because, of course, as we've seen, the Republicans killed the Watergate law by threatening a filibuster. They were outraged over the disgraceful indictment of former Reagan Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger. Recall that in Radio Free America number 26, we took a look at William S. Sessions and his role in hearing the case of about the assassination of Judge John Wood, which not only produced a considerable amount of evidence pointing in the direction of the intelligence community as complicit in the drug trade, but it even produced a confession by a guy named Charles Harrelson, who was convicted of pulling the trigger in the John Wood assassination, that he had been involved in You guessed it, the assassination of John Kennedy. That has never been proved, but of course it has also never been investigated. It is worth noting whether or not Harrelson's claim is true, and it's never been confirmed, it's also never been disproved. It is true that Charles Harrelson was part of an organized crime milieu, which intersected with that of Jack Ruby, who was certainly involved in dispatching Lee Harvey Oswald. In that very same edition of the New York Times, namely Wednesday, October 14th, there's an article by Neil A. Lewis, Dateline Washington, on October 13th, headlined, Barr Rejects Request for Theft Inquiry, subheaded Blocking a Move to Name a Special Prosecutor. This concerns Attorney General William Barr's rejection of a request by the House Judiciary Committee to appoint a special prosecutor to begin investigating the Inslaw case, a very, very important national security scandal, which intersects both with the Iraqgate scandal and in particular with the Iran-Contra scandal, and there are even evidentiary tributaries running from the Inslaw investigation in the direction of the October surprise, the apparent deal cut by the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran to keep the U.S. hostages in captivity until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. But William Barr, himself a former CIA operative, an individual who left the company, that is to say the CIA, at the same time that a great many company veterans were leaving, including former director of Central Intelligence George Bush, former, quote, ex-unquote, CIA operative William Barr is not going to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate Inslaw. Perhaps not all that surprising, but very depressing nonetheless. Following piece of research, the research credit on this goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. This comes from The Invoice, which is a newsletter put out by the Printers, Inc. bookstore in Palo Alto. It is a column called Dave's Factoid. We find the following. The, quote, October surprise task force headed by Lee Hamilton is investigating the possibility that Syrian arms and drug trafficker Manzar al-Qasar was somehow involved with pro-Republican elements to delay the release of American hostages until after the 1980 election. According to a former West German police officer, al-Qasar spent 1980 at his palace in Marbella, Spain, and at a residence in São Paulo, Brazil. In the spring of 1985, al-Qasar became part of Oliver North's network, and in the mid-80s, Washington was ordering Spanish authorities not to arrest the Syrian. With this immunity, al-Qasar expanded his traffic of drugs and stolen luxury cars, some of which passed through São Paulo. And the sources that Dave White had for this, phoning the October Surprise Task Force himself, a German book and a Spanish newspaper. Again, there is no indication that Manzar al-Qasar was involved with October Surprise, but according to Dave White, and apparently his research was also assisted by a listener named Ron Davis, the October Surprise Committee is looking into the possibility that Manzar al-Qasar may have been involved in that particular event. Of course, in Radio Free America number 35, we looked at Manzar al-Qasar and his involvement in his almost certain involvement in the bombing of Pan Am 103. Certainly he was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and deeply involved with U.S. intelligence. And we went into Manzar al-Qasar's situation first in Radio Free America 32 with his collaboration with Oliver North, and then my working hypothesis 3 weeks after the bombing of Pan Am 103 was that Manzar al-Qasar was the central element necessitating a cover-up and the bombing of 103. Then the Aviv report, the Pan Am 103 insurance investigators report, came out indicating that, in fact, Manzar al-Qasar himself was involved in the bombing of Pan Am 103. That has been suggested by other sources, and the investigation at this point remains in limbo. I doubt personally that it will ever reach any sort of satisfactory conclusion. The official version, of course, is that it was the Libyans. We've gone into Manzar al-Qasar's situation at great length. And by the way, I'm going to be discussing these articles at much greater length next week and in weeks to come. But by way of taking a look at the symptoms of the disease I've been discussing in RFA 37, research and translation credit for the following also goes to Dave White. This is from the Spanish daily ABC from September 30th of 1992. Ismael Qasid, K-H-A-S-I-D, a Spanish citizen of Lebanese origin, crashed through a fourth-floor window to his death late Monday in Marbella. Qasid's apartment was locked from the inside. There were no signs of a struggle or forced entry. The key was found on the body of the deceased. Kassid was the principal witness against international arms trafficker Manzer al-Kassar, who's charged with the hijacking of the Achille Lauro and with the attack on Elias Awad, A-W-A-D, a Lebanese intelligence agent, just as the investigation into the rapidity with which Manzer al-Kassar obtained an Argentine passport was frustrated by the death in an auto accident of the judge. Apparently, the investigation into Manzer al-Kassar in Spain is going to go into limbo because the primary witness has now, quote, committed suicide, unquote. Of course, one of the things that we've looked at in the past is that Manzer al-Kassar had used the Merex Corporation for the Aria weapons deal that figured in the Iran-Contra scandal, and it was conducted on behalf of Ali Noor's Contra Support Network. Recall that the Merex Corporation was founded by Gerhard Mertens, a World War II associate of Otto Skorzeny, and Skorzeny himself was deeply involved with Merex. In Radio Free America number 19, we took a look at Merex as the front for the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the fourth and final incarnation of the Reinhard Gehlen organization. And we also took a look in addenda to Radio Free America 35 at the close association between Abu Abbas, and we also looked at this in RFA 32, between Abu Abbas and a German neo-Nazi named Otfried Hepp. Abu Abbas was involved in the Achille Lauro hijacking, as was Manzer al-Kassar. And in an addendum to RFA 35, we took a look at the direct association between Manzer al-Kassar and Otfried Hepp. One has to wonder, perhaps, whether Manzer al-Kassar might in some way, and this is simply a question I'm asking, not a statement I'm making, one wonders whether perhaps Manzer al-Kassar himself might have some contact with the residual Nazi networks which are operating around the world. And they are still in place today, and it's not something, although it has unfortunately been relegated to fiction, unfortunately it is not fiction. Research credit on the following also goes to Dave White. This is from El Tiempo of June 22nd of 1992. Senator Cranston is asking Attorney General Barr's office to explain the relationship between al-Kassar and Spanish intelligence CESID. Cranston wants to know whether al-Kassar is now or has ever been protected by the Spanish government, and if so, the reasons why. A spokesman for CESID denied any contacts with al-Kassar. On August 22, 1987, the Interior Ministry declared al-Kassar persona non grata and expelled him. While in exile, al-Kassar maintained privileged contact with CESID. During this time, two very important Interior Ministry officials visited him in Vienna and asked for his help in freeing two French journalists held in Lebanon. Also during this period, al-Kassar was able to regularly visit his family in Marbella without any problem. In mid-1990, al-Kassar acquired a permit to reside in Spain. Last May, a police spokesman assured El Tiempo that there were no charges pending against al-Kassar. So al-Kassar apparently, in addition to having been protected by the U.S. ambassador, as we saw in an addendum to RFA 35, has also been protected by Spanish intelligence. In our last installment, we looked at the very cozy relationship between the Spanish intelligence agency DGS and Otto Skorzeny, the World War II Nazi commando hero and a primary organizer of the Odessa, the post-World War II Nazi SS underground, and Otto Skorzeny, according to Henrik Krüger in The Great Heroin Coup, single-handedly controlled the Spanish intelligence agency DGS, and the headquarters for Skorzeny's Paladin Mercenary Group shared an office with another Spanish intelligence agency, the SCOE, and an office of the U.S. CIA, a relationship which should not really come to as too surprising to those of us familiar with the development of our national security establishment. Last week, we also took a look at Operation Condor, an operation that was involved with elements of U.S. intelligence, that involved the Coru anti-Castro organization, and whose origins went down to a Nazi colony in Chile that had been used as a torture center by the DINA, the Chilean secret police, and that was in turn in contact with the worldwide post-World War II Nazi underground. In research and translation credit on the follow for the following goes to Dave as well, Dave White. This is from La Repubblica of March 9th of 1990. In the revelations of Joe Cufaro, C-U-F-F-A-R-O, there's also the incredible story of Alexander Schwerter, S-C-H-W-E-R-T-E-R, a German-born Chilean who left Santiago during the Allende government. Herr Schwerter is a very wealthy Nazi. Quote, he owns a collection of paintings worth $30 million, even a Van Gogh worth 15 billion lira, unquote, who works for quite a few people. The narco-traffickers of Medellin, the Palermitan mafiosi of Acquasanta, A-Q-U-A-S-A-N-T-A, and of the CIA. So bear in mind, this fellow, Alexander Schwerter, has a wide variety of employers, not only narco-traffickers, but also mafiosi and, not surprisingly, the CIA. Quote, I learned this from John Galatolo, G-A-L-A-T-O-L-O, who also told me that after having killed three people, Schwerter tore out their hearts in order to take them to someone, unquote. The Nazi friend had the task of, quote, washing, unquote, the money coming from the cocaine traffics. Cufaro explained, quote, one day, he even told me that he would introduce me to a banker in Italy who would take care of recycling our money, unquote. Again quoting, are we talking about the German with the dogs, the judges asked? Quote, exactly, unquote, answered the penitito. He's a man who has some well-trained attack dogs that spring at the slightest wink of his eyes. The German is a lover of weapons, above all remote control bombs. One day, Schwerter gave Cufaro a syringe filled with poison. The, quote, picciotto, unquote, took it to the office of the Scirocco Fan Company in Miami and gave it to a certain David. They had to kill someone quietly. Recall last week we took a look at the chapter of Henrik Kruger's great heroin coup entitled The Miami Conspiracy, and we traced that milieu through Operation Condor, the assassination of Orlando Letelier, and also all the way down to Colonia Dignidad in Chile. One wonders whether Alexander Schwerter may have been part of that milieu. Certainly there are indications he may have been or might be still. More about Alexander Schwerter, this from the Corriere della Sera of March 9, 1990, also researched and translated for us by Dave White. Cufaro also talked about such little-known narco-traffickers as Alexander Schwerter, a German-born Chilean in the guidance of a Nazi organization, ruthless to the point of tearing the hearts out of his victims. Quote, I met him at my company, Scirocco Fan, where Galatolo and the Colombians used to come, unquote. Cufaro recounted everything, including a Van Gogh worth 15 billion lira displayed in a drawing room. One wouldn't think that this ruthless 40-year-old who loved to surround himself with ferocious attack dogs was paid by the CIA while providing narco-dollar, quote, washing, unquote, for 15% of the money. Well, in fact, a knowledgeable observer of the U.S. national security establishment would presume exactly such a thing, given the history of elements of our national security establishment being involved with the drug trade, this shouldn't come as any great surprise at all. And before we take a musical break here, another article which bears an interesting echo from the past, and again, I'm just touching on these articles. I'll be going into them at greater length in weeks to come, but by way of enumerating the symptoms of the disease that I've been describing in RFA 37 and taking a look at the effects upon American democracy of our involvement with the Galen milieu, which simply deepened the involvement of significant American institutions with fascism. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, October 9th of 1992, a Reuters story, Dateline Washington, headlined, U.S. mistakenly freed Mengele in 1945. Subheaded, newly released report confirms that Nazi doctor was in custody. First paragraph, the notorious Nazi camp doctor Josef Mengele had been taken into U.S. custody in two separate prisoner of war camps in Germany in 1945, the notorious Nazi death camp doctor Josef Mengele had been taken into U.S. custody in two separate prisoner of war camps in Germany in 1945, but was released by mistake, a Justice Department report said yesterday. Well, mistake or not remains to be determined. Personally, I'm skeptical that it was a mistake. One of the things we've looked at in the past is a declassified FBI memorandum indicating that, in fact, Josef Mengele was an American citizen, naturalized American citizen from 1932 on. In any event, some of the symptoms, some of the indications of the disease that we have contracted and some of the indications that, in fact, we have lost the Second World War, because the things that I have been discussing should not take place in a democratic society, and the price we have paid for allowing the national security state to operate with impunity has been to corrupt our democracy out of all possible, completely corrupt our democracy out of shape, and we are now plunging, as I have attempted to illustrate over these years, plunging down the road to overt German-style fascism. The ultimate, the most important effect in my mind, or to my way of thinking, I should say, of having lost World War II, is that our political system has succumbed to fascism. After a short musical break, we're going to come back and we're going to take a look at events going on in Europe at the present time by way of taking a look at the headlines that are going on in our papers, reflective of the headlines that the German character in high command was calling the attention of the American Dummkopfs to way back in 1944.